Hello, and welcome to Leaders for Business as Unusual, exploring views from progressive green business leaders. In this episode, Dr. Charles Barthold, Senior Lecturer in Human Resources Management and Organisation Studies at the Open University, talks to Douglas Lamont, the CEO of Innocent Drinks.
Could you introduce yourself, please, and could you please introduce the organization which you are involved in leading, please?
Yeah, so I'm Douglas. I am the CEO of Innocent Drinks, and Innocent is a fruit and smoothie business. We started in 1999. We have a very clear purpose to help people on the planet to live well and die old. And, you know, we've grown from a startup in 1999 to over a 500 million euro business today, and we've become the number one juice and smoothie brand across the whole of Europe. I'm also a chair of something called the Better Business Act, which is a campaign of over 1,000 businesses, campaigning to change the Companies Act, specifically about directors' responsibilities, to make it really clear in law that directors have a responsibility not just to profit maximize, but to balance people, profit, and planet through their actions in the boardroom.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next question. How do you understand the role of your organization in relation to the ecological emergency?
We're an integral part of the solution, is how I understand our responsibility. So we have, you know, a purpose, as I've talked about, to help people and the planet to live well and die old. And therefore, everything that we do and think about is about how we find the balance between being a successful, profitable business, but doing it the right way so that we're not taking from the world. We're taking profit for ourselves, but not at the cost of people and not at the cost of the planet. And making sure that those things are in balance. You know, inside the company, we talk about the business being good all round. And it's our responsibility as leaders and responsibility of everyone in the company to think about that balance as we drive the business forward.
Great. Thank you. I'll now move to a few questions about your leadership and potential challenges. So first question, what do you find most challenging about leading an organization and making choices to prioritize ecological sustainability? Would you have any examples of particular situations, please?
So I think people, you know, tend to talk about, oh, well, it's profit or sustainability, or it's profit or investment in your people. And I just think that's the wrong paradigm. I think increasingly, you know, it's being proven that businesses think about all three things in balance are more successful companies. And you only need to look to the B Corps around the world, and there are now over 5,000 B Corps that are taking up those principles, and they're clearly significantly outperforming their competitors, you know, in general. And therefore, this sort of choice of one or the other, it's that one versus that one, I think is an outdated concept or set of thinking. And what we have to demonstrate, and my personal passion and the passion of businesses like Innocent, is to demonstrate that it's not just the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do to be a successful business, and that that can scale. You know, Innocent's now over 500 million of turnover following those principles. And yes, you have to make trade-offs, but all businesses make trade-offs every day. Do we invest in, you know, launching into a new market, or do we invest more in our people, or do we invest, you know, or do we hold on to that money in case there's a rainy day? Or all we're doing with the sustainability challenges is introducing a new variable. So it's not a suddenly different way of doing business, it's just introducing new trade-offs that you have to make. But making trade-offs is what businesses have been doing for hundreds of years. So I think we've just got to think about this in the right way and almost not be scared of it. Say, what's the opportunity in getting the trade-off right?
Thank you. Next question. Are there situations when you look back that you feel that you didn't make the best organizational choices in acting for ecological sustainability? So would you have done something differently, potentially?
Life's full of regrets, right? And there's lots of things that we haven't got right over the years. I think the biggest mistake we make is about the pace at which we make decisions. So take carbon footprint, understanding your carbon footprint and then setting clear targets to reduce it. I think we, like many, were guilty of, right, let's really understand to the nth degree what our carbon footprint is, and then let's really understand the model that tells us if we do these things, what might then happen. And you can get yourself lost in the, oh, but if we say this, are we going to make it to that target? Or, you know, there's lots of whats and buts and ifs in between where you are and where you need to be. And I would say, like many, we've been guilty of overthinking the detail of the targets. You know, we talk it innocent about being 70% sure and then go for it. And I think in carbon setting targets in particular, that's where leaders need to be. They need to say, okay, I've done quite a bit of logic, I've done quite a bit of analysis, I've got my gut feel, I'm 70% sure that this is the brave journey that we need to go on. Right, put the stake in the ground. Because until you put the stake in the ground and say, right, we're going to be, you know, carbon neutral by 2025 and net zero by 2040, which is the choices that we've made, it doesn't really galvanize the organization to action. While you're kind of swirling around to set the target, nothing really happens. There's lots of data flying around. So in your decision-making around these things, how do you get to putting the stake in the ground as quickly as possible, I think is the key thing we all need to think about. And because it is an emergency and we all need to act quickly, I just want to encourage people to get those stakes in the ground. And if they're 70% right, that's going to be more than good enough.
Okay, great. Thank you. So next question. In your organization, are there situations when there have been tensions between acting uncompromisingly for ecological sustainability and attaining financial profits? Would you have some examples?
As I said earlier, I think there are always trade-offs in business, but I think people look at them at too narrow a lens. So, you know, an example right now is we've got 50% recycled plastic in our bottles. We want to be at 100% recycled. And that was the journey we were going on, and we were on track to do that for next year. In the meantime, thank goodness, the world has changed very quickly and everyone wants recycled packaging right now. There's not enough supply. There's a ridiculous amount of demand, which is a brilliant positive because we've been encouraging the whole system to change, which means the price is completely bonkers. So for us to then say, right, for the next 12 months, we're going to pay that bonkers price for the last 50%, it doesn't make any sense because we know we'll make the change. Once, and as soon as supply is at the right level, the pricing will be normal. We're just proud that the change in the system is happening. And in 2025, most people will be on 100% recycled at a sensible price because the infrastructure, you know, supply and demand still follows in sustainability too. And so you kind of go, oh, we're slower than we said we were going to be. And it's a bit of a compromise. And we could, if we paid this crazy price, go for it. But actually, if you take a step further back, you say, well, we're going to end up where we need to be. The world is changing around us. And this is never about sustainability as a team sport. You know, innocent being good on its own is completely pointless. You need everybody. You need the buffalo herd to move. And so the fact is, in recycled plastic, the herd is charging, which is brilliant news. And so kind of run with the herd rather than just run to be first is sort of how we sort of see this last leg of the journey on recycled plastic, you know, as one example. But also, some people look at the sort of trade-off and say, right, the economic cost in this year's P&L is this versus that. And, oh, it's going to cost me to do that this year. But is it going to create value for your company? You know, Innocent, as I said, didn't exist in 1999. We're now the number one in the market. We've made those trade-offs all along. Sometimes our P&L might not be as good as our competitor, but we've beaten our competitor, we've got a bigger market share, and we're now more valuable as a company and as a proposition. So sometimes if you focus on too short a window or too narrow a set of parameters, you're not understanding the value that you're creating. So I would encourage people to say, what's value creation over the long term when you're thinking about sustainability? Because that's the way to sort of think about it. I would also flip it on its head and say, more often than not, we're pleasantly surprised by thinking with a lens of sustainability how much low-hanging fruit there is to save cost. So, you know, people come into this journey and the first 80 yards are actually really quite easy because you go, oh, well, if I switch to that, it's cheaper. Or actually switching to green electricity doesn't really cost me any more in today's world and, in fact, might cost me less. And, you know, we've just built an absolute carbon zero factory in Rotterdam. We made more investments up front to bring down the energy usage through the design and put in wind and solar, but that actually made the business case better because the returns against electricity come early in the business case, So our return on investment actually went up. We had to put more capital in up front, but our return that we were demonstrating to our shareholders went up. 2 years later, now we've built it and electricity prices and oil prices have gone through the roof. That business case is only getting better because we made a sustainability choices. So now, instead of my return being here, it's actually going to be here because the electricity assumptions have, you know, been proven to be horribly wrong and they were going to be much more expensive. So it's funny how actually we're finding these choices 2 or 3 years down the line towards sustainability suddenly start to look better, not worse.
Thank you. That's really interesting indeed. Okay, so I'll move to other questions now about your leadership and good practices. So first one, what do you think is involved in being a good leader in your organization? Do you have any examples, please?
So I describe my job description. My job description is purpose, vision, our purpose, vision, and values. So all I have to think about is the organization going in the right direction against our purpose, vision, and values? So, you know, have we got clarity of our long-term direction? Are we clear on the sort of vision and then the strategy to get to the next jump? You know, then where's the next rock? Where's the next 3 years? And then I get through values. Am I hiring the right sorts of people? And am I attracting the right sort of talent to deliver against that purpose, vision, and strategy? As a CEO, the danger is you meddle in the detail too much rather than looking at the big picture. And quite often the big picture can then get lost and then the organization is lost. Having said that, sometimes you have to learn when to really dive down into the detail. You know, I describe it as, yes, the CEO should probably be on the top floor, not physically, but metaphorically. But they have to know when to get into the lift to go down to the basement to check the plumbing or clarify that the plumbing's working or help fix the plumbing. But they also have to learn pretty quickly how to get out of there really quickly. Because if you stay down too long in the basement, you're doing the wrong job. You're fixing the plumbing and then you're going to be pissing people off and confusing them and doing all those things. So generally, how does the leadership group set an inspiring vision and hire the right people, but also let those people know that occasionally you're going to dive into the detail because it's important. And carbon footprinting that we talked about earlier is a really good example. You're setting a choice for your business for the next 20 years, and you have to really understand the detail before you get the business to that. So get into the detail. Don't fly at 10,000 feet for that one. But that balance between enjoying the view from the top floor, but also accepting that sometimes you dive down would be one of my thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you. That's really, really interesting indeed. Next one, how would you say your leadership style is different from mainstream green businesses, if you think it is, of course?
Yeah, I would sort of change the question slightly. I think there are, in my head, and this is a very simple caricature, let's call it that, there are kind of three buckets of companies right now. There's the companies that don't really want to change, but know that it's sustainability is an issue. So what they do is they brief their public affairs people to say, can you please come up with the best press release possible that makes me sound really good, but means I don't really have to change anything that we do. Bucket one. And there's still too many people in that, but fortunately that group is shrinking. The middle camp is a group of people that are definitely on the journey to get to the right place. And they say, right, what we're going to do, this is all big and confusing and we can't afford to do everything. They pick one topic and say, right, we're going to do that topic really well. Everyone's going to be focused on it. We're going to have big KPIs. We're going to shout about it on LinkedIn. And they focus on one thing, but then the rest of the business doesn't really change. They just carry on doing what they do. But they're very proud of their one thing. And then there's the third camp, which says, no, we are going to be a truly sustainable company, and we're going to build this thinking and decision-making fully into the organization, into every choice, into every decision. We're going to basically engage the people from the bottom up to be making these decisions at a micro level day to day, rather than those decisions coming from the C-suite on big initiatives that are PR-able. It's just like, how do you build it in from the bottom? And you know, increasingly that number is going up, far too few still. And B Corps are a good example of companies that are doing that well, but so are many others. You know, there are lots of others in that camp. The job that we all have to do, governments, business leaders like myself advocating for change, is move the herd through that cycle as quickly as possible. So more and more companies sit in that third bucket, and that's where I think Innocent sits. I think we're lucky at Innocent that that was our founding principle, and so it was built in from day one. And hands up, it's way harder to retrofit that into a big organization. So the bravest leaders are the ones that are, you know, in very big organizations that then retrofit that. And that's a rocky journey. And as others like Paul Pommel will tell you, that's a rocky journey. But they're the brave leaders that should be held the highest, because if you change a big oil tanker in that direction, you know, you really have done a service to the world. So it's not easy, but we just need everybody to be in a camp where, you know, sustainable businesses think about it in everything, not as two or three big initiatives that the C-suite can sign off.
Yeah, thank you. That's really interesting indeed. And one dimension that you touched upon a little bit is of course the question of accountability, and the fact that probably, or at least that's a point that is made by lots of business leaders, but also a little bit in research, that the cost of greenwashing in a way is very low now. So you don't really have, or it's very difficult to find accountability measures, KPIs that, you know, that would really be universally agreed upon, like, I don't know, you know, a financial rating. If you had something like that for sustainability, it might help, but that's difficult.
Agreed. And I think I know today's talked about sustainability, but when you get into diversity, inclusion and social justice and all those things, that's where I do think B Corp has its strength, because it says, it looks at, to a certain level, you know, what does this company do in each of those buckets? And it asks really great questions against each of those areas. And what we found is we've deployed that into the business and the teams. Those teams then use those good decisions about each area of the business in their day-to-day decision making. It's like, oh, well, am I doing that? Or in this choice about which supplier I use, is this one better versus that one against this set of criteria? So if you can make it happen from the bottom up, that's really important. But I'm with you on the measures. I mean, it's really hard, but you know, right now, sitting here today, we've just heard that government might be pushing back its kind of, you know, sustainability metric measures and corporate governance reforms, which were driving at some of the ESG things. That's disappointing, partly probably because it is really hard, but like all these things, you just have to keep editing them. Creating auditing standards back in 1900 was probably a complete nightmare, but over time, you've just got to keep, you know, each time the tide comes in on these things, are we a bit further up the beach? Is the pebble moving further up the beach? Because we'll get it right, but we've got to go at pace, and that's the judgment that everyone's got to make. Yeah, I mean, if you want to greenwash, you can greenwash right today. So is it in your heart that you're doing the right thing as a leader? Is probably the thing that we have to land to people, because every rule can be twisted or manipulated or PR'd. It's like, how do we shift that mindset so that leaders want to do it with their heart as well as with their head, is actually the thing that we've got to focus on. It's like, what's the payoff in society? You know, smoking used to be fine. It's not fine today. Being a business leader of this type is still okay today, because people that make loads of money are put up on pedestals, irrelevant of the cost to the rest of the world. How do we change that as a culture? You know, these are the things beyond just fine sets of rules. There's a culture shift that needs to happen as well. And that these things are hard. So you can't, no one's got the magic answer, otherwise it would have been done. But more and more leaders, and that's what I'm encouraged about, as you see the next generation coming through, it's way more ingrained. It's way more that trade-off is naturally in their brain, because they're getting it at school. They're getting it through the university education like you guys are giving. It's like, of course I'm going to do that. And the quicker we can get to that generation leading, the better, because the problems will sort of naturally solve themselves, because people won't be looking for they'll be thinking in the new way rather than the old way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Indeed. And clearly there are a lot of good signs about cultural change in terms of the management community, but also consumers. Now you have much more ethical consumption, and people are, or you have more people now who are ready to pay more money if, you know, if they know that a product is sustainable, which didn't exist 40 years ago. So indeed,
and didn't exist 10 years ago.
So, yeah, even absolutely.
You know, or even 5 years ago. This shift is suddenly happening very fast. I'm very pleased. You know, Innocent was ahead of trend and grew and whatever, but actually it was much more about our brand and our sort of the way that we ran the company and the people side that got the attraction in those days. It's only in the latter years that, oh, the sustainability piece has come through more strongly, and now our positioning and our marketing is very focused in that area because it's become relevant and important in a way that, for right or wrong, wasn't there 5 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. So there are positive signs indeed. And even my point, in fact, about accountability was really about finance, basically, where you now at a very high level you have those discussions that happen with investors in you know, hedge funds and so on,
and the investment community is definitely shifting. What I find interesting is I think the investment community is waking up to the long-term value creation point and suddenly going, okay, how do we invest in these businesses, where are they, who are they? I think there's a set of progressive companies that are already following that practice and more each day. There's a certain bunch of old school leaders that aren't behaving like that. And they're the ones that seem to be in the ears of most of the politicians, because the politicians are probably moving the slowest on this because they're like, oh, big business doesn't necessarily want this. I think they should be talking to big investors and really understanding, actually, this wheel needs to go faster, not slower. Like, the fear that we're going to destroy value by setting higher standards, I just think is a false paradigm. Whether that's through a country lens or through a global lens, if we all make this shift together and fast, you know, we'll solve the problems. In the same way that each of these big paradigm shifts that happened over the years, everyone say, oh, but, you know, if cars come along, this terrible thing's going to happen. The downsides will be solved or offset by much bigger upsides. And the biggest upside of all is we're going to have a planet to live on. So people better wake up to that, because without that, you know, the game's over anyway. So and my only fear, yes, you can say the next generation will be ready and solve it. Is that too late? And, you know, we have to wake up to the fact that if actually we don't teach some of these old dogs new tricks, it could be late for the people that wanted the change, too late for the people that wanted the change and have the power in 10 or 15 years time. Because if you believe what you read, it's the next 10 years that really counts in terms of the tipping points. So it's not about just waiting for the next generation to solve this. We have to all step over the concerns or step over the abyss of this and make it happen today.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'll move to the next questions, which were really on what we are talking about now. So you'll be able to elaborate a little bit, hopefully. So here it is. Based on debates at Glasgow and beyond, what is exciting and frustrating you in terms of business addressing the environmental emergency?
Yeah, well, you slightly covered it in the last answer. I was really encouraged at COP. This is the first COP where it felt like business had a very strong voice. I think up to this point, business was a sideshow, not really, particularly because it was in the UK, maybe as a British business. I think it was British business or global business pushing for a louder voice and pushing for what can be achieved, how can we do it together, how can we work in partnership. So I was actually pleased to see that you know, shift that we talked about earlier about how do more businesses say really commit to going on the journey. I think it's clear that more and more are with each day. So is it fast enough? Don't know. Suspect not. But is it moving? Yes. So that's good. Are the signals being received by the people that at COP actually make the decisions, the politicians and then the intra-country trade-offs? And, oh, if I agree to that, am I at a strategic financial disadvantage? The niggling around what people commit to was disappointing. In terms of it felt less brave than Paris, which is a concern, considering we haven't made enough progress since Paris and there's no evidence that things have got better. In fact, quite a lot worse since Paris in terms of the speed at which change is required. So I'm an optimist and I believe in if we all put in enough here, the tipping points will come. I feel like the tipping points with businesses are being reached. How do we make that translate into tipping points with what I would call old school companies, governments, and to some extent, some of the investment community, not all. I think some of the investment community have really woken up to this. So it's just the overall pace of change is not fast enough. Is I think all everyone's frustrations, but certain sectors are suddenly moving a bit quicker than others, is the way that I would see it.
Yeah, absolutely. So final question on which you already touched a little bit, but this might be an opportunity to elaborate or to emphasize a key point, I guess. So what needs to happen in terms of change for businesses so they can address the environmental emergency?
I'm going to go to COVID. We can't have an interview these days without talking about COVID. What we saw in COVID was that in a crisis, government and business can work highly effectively together to solve problems really fast. And what I'm really interested in is why is that not happening? What around this other crisis that we've got around sustainability? You know, it's not so immediate. There's not such a, you know, deaths every day on the news, but it's an equally big crisis with much, much bigger consequences than the crisis that we've just gone through in terms of human life and poverty and, you know, all the value destruction and all of those things. It's like, how do we close the gap from the, you know, the it still feels like a theory of a threat rather than fear really being there to then drive that partnership between government and business to solve it. Because the minute you get business and government in harness, and genuinely everybody saying this is for the, you know, the national good or the global good, it will do whatever it takes. Look how the world moves. I mean, incredible. So we as humans have the power to solve this problem. We're getting in our own way by not recognizing the ecological challenge as enough of a crisis in terms of the sort of, you know, fear drives action. And whilst I'm not advocating for everyone to be fearful all the time, what are the conditions that make that more front of mind for people? And, you know, love it or hate it, Don't Look Up has been a sort of good parody of that to some extent. What does it take for people to go, God, I really do need to act? And then once we've got that, your business will shift overnight, governments will turn on the sixpence and invest in the way that they did through COVID. And that's my sort of plea, is that businesses act together to galvanize governments to kind of work in partnership, because there's no point having a them and us between business and government. And it feels way far too often like a Punch and Judy show. Oh, it's the government politician's fault. Oh, it's business's fat cat's fault. It's not our fault. This is a collective responsibility. And if we work together, we've got no chance. So I'm all about how do we harness both things coming together for real change. That would be my sort of summary. Sadly, I don't have the magic answer on how that happens. I just have the passion to try and to keep trying.
Thank you so much. This is really interesting indeed, extremely, extremely relevant. But as you said, a number of things are happening now. I mean, some key players have made statements, commitments. For example, you know, I don't know, the Norwegian Sovereign Fund, which is something very big, for example, made, you know, very clear commitments. And you see very, very large corporations also starting to change. So we'll see what happens. But thank you so much again for this interview.
Thank you for listening. This project was completed in 2022 by Dr. Stephen Allen at the University of Sheffield and Dr. Charles Bartold at the Open University. Their work was supported by a grant from the Society of the Advancement of Management Studies. The progressive green business leaders interviewed are identified as people who do business differently by working uncompromisingly for ecological sustainability. The recorded interviews have been produced and uploaded for others to use in their teaching and learning. For more information, please email stephen.allen@sheffield.ac.uk or charles.bartold@open.ac.uk.